What I'd like to do is just pick up a couple of insights from the Purim story that I think are enlightening and we can learn from in terms of the situation happening today, specifically in Israel. And not just in Israel, anti-Semitism outside of Israel, because the whole Purim story took place where? Anybody know? It took place not in Israel, it took place outside of Israel. In fact, one of the reasons we don't say Hallel, Hallel is a very beautiful Jewish prayer we say on all the festivals, and we say it on Hanukkah, but we don't say Hallel on Purim. Hallel is just a bunch of psalms together, and we say, anybody know why don't we say Hallel on Purim?
Because it didn't happen in Israel.
Because it didn't happen in Israel, okay? And thank you so much. And since it did not happen in Israel, it doesn't get the other reason is because what's the ending of the Purim story? Happy ending or sad ending?
Happy.
It's happy because
Jews are saved
from, you know, attempted annihilation. 14th of Adar, the Hebrew month of Adar, Haman pulled a number out of a hat. That's why it's called Purim. The Hebrew word for Purim is Pur, which is lottery. Just get this back. Thank you. We were saved, so let's celebrate. So why don't we say Hallel? Because it didn't happen in Israel. We were still saved.
A lot of people still died.
There were people that died, actually, not too many Jews. At the end of the Megillah, the Jewish people had to defend themselves against the mobs that started to develop from the date that Haman said you could start killing Jews. But the other reason is because what happened in the aftermath, we may not even realize this, which is different than Hanukkah. What happened with Hanukkah? How is it? Hanukkah, they also tried to destroy us, the Greeks. We kicked them out. But what's the fundamental difference between Hanukkah and Purim in terms of the final ending?
There's no miracles.
Okay, that's Hanukkah seems to have a little more overt miracles going on, you know? Doesn't seem to any miracle going on in the whole Megillah. It seems like a very ordinary kind of story. Anti-Semite gets the upper hand. We've got a Jewish queen in the palace. She saves the day. You don't even have to interpret or read God into this thing at all. In fact, God's name is not mentioned anywhere in the Megillah. The only part of Hebrew scripture where God's name is conspicuously absent. But think about it. What was the aftermath? When the Hanukkah story is over, the Jews in Israel are living how? And when the Purim story is in ancient Persia, the Jews are living how? We were saved in both of those instances. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. But how were they left? Well, in Israel, they were left doing what? Sovereignty. We were the masters of our own fate. We kicked the Greeks out of one of their colonies. And we continue to rule over ourselves. Purim?
In the diaspora.
We stayed in the diaspora, living under who?
The king.
The king. Which king? It's a tough one. His name is Achashverosh. Say that 10 times fast. Achashverosh. We remained servants, basically, to Achashverosh. Now, maybe as American Jews, we don't feel like, oh, that's such a bad thing, because we like living in America, and it's pretty good here, except when it's not pretty good. But one of the lessons that Rabbi Soloveitchik teaches from the story, and that's something I think is very relevant, and that is there's a certain vulnerability of the Jew in the diaspora. Turn the page. I have here, I just photocopied from a couple of lessons from the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. And hang on one second. I forgot which lesson that I was starting to share with you. Let's start from the beginning. But I do want to mention that. That's a really interesting thing. Like, what are Jews in Israel really fighting for? That's a little different than what we Jews in America are fighting for. Well, we want to be kind of left alone wherever we live. Okay, I guess we could all agree on that. But fundamentally, we're actually fighting for two different things. In the diaspora, we're fighting to be left alone and to be able to live peaceful lives in someone else's country. and we be proud Americans living here, you know. In Israel, we're fighting for that plus what else?
Sovereignty.
We're fighting for the ability to charter our own course of history and not be subject to someone else's plan. Even if that plan turns out okay, because here's the situation, you can't control that, and I can't control that. And no matter how many APACs we create, and how many great lobby groups, how much money we have, how many Jews in Hollywood there are, how many Jewish scientists there are, how many university presidents are Jewish. There's a really great book, and I'm not here to depress you, but it's a really good book to read. It's called The Pity of It All. I forgot the name of the author, but it's written about 250 years of Jewish culture in Germany. 250 years of Jewish culture. Now, by the way, there's a lot more than 250 years. The book just picks up 250 years before. But it's making a very, very poignant case that the Jews could live for centuries in a country, contribute like tremendously. The top scientists in pre-war Germany were Jews, including Albert Einstein and many Niels Bohrs and so many others. A lot of politicians, a lot of university professors, doctors in major hospitals in Germany, and it was the most quote-unquote civilized, you know, intellectually at least, seemed to be a very, very civilized place to live. And there was an attempt during the Third Reich, before the actual Holocaust, but after Hitler took power, to put a book together and had over 1,000 pages in this book. The Jewish community published a book highlighting all of the Jews who contributed to German culture over the last 250 years with the hope that such a book and such a record of accomplishment and such a of advancement and contribution to their society, that would sort of call off the dogs. And it had zero impact. Because anti-Semitism is irrational. It is not happening for any specific reason, such that let's find out why they hate us, and I'll just do the opposite, and then they'll love me. Here's the problem. Why did Haman hate the Jews? What's that? So it says that Mordechai, when he walked in the courtyard, Mordechai was the most prominent Jew. He was a member of the Jewish high court. He was a great rabbinic authority. He wouldn't bow before him. He got upset. What else did Haman say to Ahasuerus? Haman was very powerful and rich, but he didn't have enough power to annihilate all the Jews himself. He would still need the king's permission. He had to get the royal insignia of the king. What did Haman say to Ahasuerus to convince him to do this? Or what did he do to convince him to do this?
Money.
First of all, he gave him a lot of money. He offered to deposit tens of thousands of silver talents into the king's treasury. So, you know, Ahasuerus was basically an opportunist, you know. But he also said something very interesting. He said there is this one nation, that they're scattered amongst the provinces, because ancient Persia was like a superpower, ranging over many, many different republics, like the former Soviet Union, or you can say like the United States with different states, right? Bigger. It's probably like Russia and America together. Okay, that's how big ancient Persia was. And he said that these Jews are all over, and they don't follow our laws. They follow their own laws, and they keep to themselves. What did Hitler tell the German people to rile them up against the Jews? The exact opposite. He said that they're getting too close. Their daughters are marrying our sons. Their sons are marrying our daughters. They're taking over the banks. They've polluted the whole field of science. They're in our faces. So let's say in the times of Haman, everybody heard, the times of the story of the Purim, that everybody heard that's why they were being hated. So they started just getting more involved. And let's just be more Persian, and let's get more patriotic. And by the way, it was nonsense, because the opening story of the Purim is a big party that the king threw. And the Jews came to that party, even though Mordechai told them not to come to the party. I spoke about that last week a little. So they were involved. He made that up, that we were like, we did our own thing. It wasn't really true anyway, but he got Ahasuerus to believe it, or maybe the money did, I don't know. What did Hitler do? Just the opposite. Hitler said, they're too close. We need some distance. We got to get rid of them. And what did Hitler try to do before he tried to implement the final solution? Does anybody know what Hitler spent years trying to do to the Jews? To get them out. Okay, I worked on this when I was in graduate school many years ago. But I have a whole theory, and I showed it to a number of Holocaust scholars. All of them were agreed that Hitler tried, before he even appears, thought, I mean, I don't know if he thought about it before the final solution was even publicized anywhere, written up anywhere, there was a concerted attempt to make life so miserable for the Jew in Germany that they would leave. Now, my theory is that he wanted to prove to the world that nobody wanted the Jew. Mazel tov, welcome. That he wanted to... guys, wish a mazel tov to Fred and Lily. They just got married. That's why I was in Florida. Mazel tov, mazel tov. You're welcome to go into the other room also and let them sing and dance for you a bit also. But we're talking about Purim a little right now. Congratulations, guys. It was such a gorgeous wedding. We're talking about parallels between what's happening in the world today and in Israel and the Purim story. And so if the Jews in ancient Persia had done this, had just said, you know what, the reason they don't like us anymore, you can just grab me that. Thank you. The reason they don't like us is because... we're keeping away, so let's get more involved. And if the Jews, you know, my grandfather, blessed memory, he left Germany in 1937. Our family was there for hundreds of years, my mother's parents. And the reason he left is because, you know, the Nuremberg laws were enforced since 1933, and Germany, the Nazi party were trying to make it as difficult for Jews to stay as possible. Jews stayed anyway. That's why so many perished. Those who were, I don't want to say smart enough, but those who were bold enough to make that move and were able to get out. It wasn't so simple to come to the United States in those days, by the way. Our family moved to Liechtenstein, which is a tiny little country near Switzerland. My mother was born there, and they lived there for a few years until they got visas to come to America. But can you imagine what would have, if everybody thought because the Jews were getting too close, so then we kept aside, we pulled back, what would have happened? Would Hitler have changed his course of action against the Jews? No. The reasons given for anti-Semitism, not really reasons, they're just excuses. It's just an irrational, any form of bigotry or hatred is, there's no real reason why people enslaved black people in this country. I mean, they just made things up about black people, just like the Nazis made things up about Jews. And then you have to, but you have to rationalize it, especially if you're a civilized people with universities and research and science. You can't just say, you know, something nasty about someone. You have to give some sort of reason for it. So anyway, that's one of the things that comes out of the story that I think we need to pay attention to, and that is not to pay too much attention to the reasons anti-Semites or any other bigot give for what it is, because if you turn into the opposite, it's not going to change the result. And we know it can't be the reason, because the last generation, they hated us for the exact opposite reason. So take a look at what Rabbi Soloveitchik says. The first lesson... take a look on top. I'm sorry, it's not as bold. It says, the Megillah therefore portrays the instability and uncertainty that govern the fate of the Jew. The Egyptian Galut, you guys see that page 2 there, 179?
Yeah.
The Egyptian Galut is exile, taught the Jew ethical sensitivity. You guys know how the Egyptian Galut taught the Jew ethical sensitivity? Because how did we live in the Egyptian exile?
Uncomfortably?
Yeah. As what? Slaves,
yeah.
So what happens if you start out as a slave, or God forbid, you're abused? So there's two ways of dealing with it. A lot of abusers, people who are abused become abusers. Okay, that's what some of our enemies are accusing Israel of doing. The reason Israel is so disgusting to the Palestinians and abusing their human rights is because they were abused. Okay, they don't see it as any kind of self-defense, or that we were granted this country by the United Nations. We didn't take it by force. Yes, we've had a lot of wars, but those have been wars of defense, right? And but what we've developed out of the Egyptian exile was sensitivity. Why is it that in the forefront of almost every single human rights movement or civil rights movement, you will see Jews in the forefront? Is that just a coincidence? We're less than 1/5 of 1% of the world's population, and you show me one civil or human rights movement in the world that didn't have Jews at the forefront. Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that that came out of the fact that we started out as slaves. So we are particularly sensitive when people suffer. And that's what the bleeding heart liberal Jew, you know, we sometimes say it in a negative way, but it's actually a very positive thing. It's because we ourselves were in that position and we feel for others who are oppressed. Anyway, but that's the Egyptian galut. The Persian galut apparently was meant to provide lessons on how to survive as a people. The former made an imprint on the character of the Jews, while the latter, Purim, was concerned to perpetuate the physical entity of the people. Until the destruction of the temple in 586 BCE, the first commonwealth was nourished by the lessons of the Egyptian sojourn, and for the second commonwealth, an additional inspirational experience was necessary in the face of threats to the survival of the people. Now, let's go through some lessons here. First lesson Rabbi Soloveitchik teaches is man can become Satan. We were the ones who brought this idea to the world that people are good. Why do we believe people are good inherently? Because we believe in the soul. We believe in a God who created humanity with a soul. And if you have a soul, that means you have great capacity for goodness. But Rabbi Soloveitchik argues that just because you have a soul and just because you have that goodness in you from God doesn't mean you can't become evil or bad. Follow with me. Our faith in man's goodness should not blind us to the latent demonic in man. Evidently, civilized men can become the personification of evil. The thin veneer of social restraint can suddenly be lifted, exposing the ugly, brutish potential of man. Creating the image of God, man can also assume a satanic identity. And this is difficult. My wife and I, we went to Israel about a month after the war, and we went to Kfar Aza, which is one of the areas along the Gaza Strip on the border that was brutally, brutally attacked. And we met with people who, amazing, amazing people, who were friends with Gazans, who were trying to help and lobbying on their behalf to get them work permits to come more and more often into Israel. And they were used. Because when Hamas came in on October 7th, how do you think they knew exactly where to go? Where this was, where that was, how to foil a lot of our defenses because of the goodness. Now, I'm not saying that you could take this and become just like a really negative person and think everybody's out to kill you, everyone's out, you know. But these were very good-hearted people who believed in the goodness of their neighbors. And now, it's not like everybody in the Gaza Strip, you know, was in favor of what happened on October 7th. But it was a lot of people, unfortunately. And we have to be able to still believe in the goodness of people and not become naive and not stop believing. Too many knots there. And continue to believe that people can do the wrong thing still. And that's a hard balance to achieve. To say man is good, people are good inherently, but people can go bad and they can become satanic. Now what does that have to do with the Purim story? Because our ancestors were living side by side with their Persian friends, going to work with them. They went to the party. The Megillah opens up with this amazing party that Ahasuerus threw for everyone, and Jews and non-Jews came and they were drinking it up and having a good time with each other. And then something changed. And I used to speak to my grandmother, blessed memory, who came from Germany, and all of her friends it was very hard for her to talk about the friends that she had in Germany who kept quiet when the Nazis came to power. Now, it was dangerous to speak up. Okay, I don't mean to say like, oh, they could have just changed everything overnight. Anyone who tried opposing Hitler was put down pretty quickly. But there were a lot of accomplices that happily helped the Nazis, and not just in Germany, but in other Nazi-occupied areas. I'm sorry to keep going into World War II. It's just the part of history I know more about, and there's just a lot of parallels between the Purim story and the Second World War and now what happened on October 7. So just continue with me. The thin veneer of social restraint can suddenly be lifted, exposing the ugly, brutish potential of man. Now that line, when I read that line and I saw what was going on college campus or what happened here just last week on the Upper West Side, there was an Israeli establishment that was graffitied and red paint. And, you know, it says the thin veneer of social restraint can suddenly be lifted, exposing a certain ugly, brutish potential of man. Creating the image of God, man can assume a satanic identity. He is capable from time to time of going berserk, of turning into a monster. Now, it's okay, Rabbi Soloveitchik is not saying, therefore, don't talk to non-Jews. Don't have anything to do with them. They're all out to get you. He's not saying that. He's saying that we have to believe that people have that capacity. Because if we don't believe people have that capacity, and we just think because we're loved today, we will be loved tomorrow. Yeah, this is a little uncomfortable stuff. Mm-hmm. Take a look. Let's turn the page. This was a traumatic discovery for the Jews of Persia. Top of the page. This is a traumatic discovery for the Jews of Persia. The Jew believes intuitively in man's inherent goodness, that a divine spark inhabits every human being, even the habitual sinner and criminal. This is the basis of tshuva, that the kernel of man's soul ever remains uncontaminated and may yet induce a moral regeneration. Like, we don't give up on anyone. In Haman, the Jews of Persia met a descendant of Amalek. Then he goes into a whole thing about Amalek, certain people, this nation that attacked the Jews when we left Egypt, and they're more than just a Bedouin tribe. Look at the bottom of the page. In our generation, Hitler and Stalin are clearly Amalek personified. Jews in Germany and even in concentration camps discounted rumors of mass killings until it was too late. In communist Russia, many Jews continued to support Stalin, despite his demonstrated tyranny and anti-Semitism. The Jew is naive in his faith in man and is therefore particularly vulnerable. Can it happen here? The Jews of Persia probably asked themselves incredulously. The first lesson of Purim is that Jews everywhere, even those dwelling under benign conditions, must answer decidedly yes, it can happen here and elsewhere as it has occurred in the past. The ethical sensitivity and respect for man, which was so successfully imprinted within the Jewish personality by the Egyptian experience and reinforced by the preachings of the prophets, should not blind Jews to stark realities. A sober awareness of dire possibilities will hopefully lead to vigilance and precaution. Amalek is an historic phenomena. The lesson must never be forgotten. So that's one lesson. It's not a very uppy and positive and fun one, but it's a real one.
When was this written?
Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote this probably sometimes in the 50s or 60s, I think.
Right after the war.
Yeah, this is after the Holocaust, but not so much after. You know, and I'll throw it out to you. I mean, we can get into a little conversation about this, perhaps, you know, instead of just mulling over this. But, like, you know, we want to be happy Jewish Americans or American Jews, whatever you call yourself. You know, but we don't want to walk around thinking that, like, our neighbors could just sort of turn on us. We don't, and we shouldn't. And on the other hand, there are things happening. There are things happening here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's not just happening from the right now. It's also happening from the hard left. You know, it was traditionally, anti-Semitism traditionally came from the more white supremacists. And we could sort of get together with our, you know, African-American brothers and sisters and other ethnicities and minority groups. But we're now part of a sort of a white privileged minority that with a very, you know, heavy dose of wokeism can now inspire a new form of anti-Semitism. That's the kind of anti-Semitism we're seeing on college campus. It's not coming from white supremacist groups.
Yeah.
You know? I went on this rabbinic conference a couple of weeks ago, and I met a rabbi from Providence, Rhode Island. He has 8 professors in his synagogue from Brown. And he doesn't wear his yarmulke publicly anymore. The rabbi, Orthodox rabbi.
Wow.
He wears a cap. He still covers his head, but he doesn't wear a kippah. He says he doesn't feel comfortable. And there's been a lot of, and he's very close with some of his congregants who are professors at Brown, and it's not a good situation there right now. Now, I mean, hopefully it'll resolve itself. I mean, I don't know. What do you think? I'm just babbling right now.
I mean, I think the real danger right now is that, I'll take someone like, I think of myself, who couldn't have grown up more secular than me. My worry is that a lot of Jews are just going to be like, you know what? I don't really want to like deal with this issue, so I'm just going to side with them so I can hang out with my non-Jewish friends. I'll become anti, you know, it's not that important to me. It's more important to me that I fit in in social circles. And then that Judaism dies within that generation. And then basically what you'll have is a skid, you know, where can secular Judaism survive? Because secular Judaism tends to exist in places that are currently
very more left.
Well, by a certain left that is particularly inherently anti-Semitic, and it's, you know, because it's defined, basically, it's defined Israel as...
It's not, you know, it's interesting because it's not, I listened to Bill Maher. You guys listen to Bill Maher at all? Like, he considers himself, you know, a liberal progressive, but he's very anti-woke. And, you know, and I also grew up, you know, different parts of my family, some parts were a little more conservative, some parts were more liberal. It wasn't like really such a big deal, honestly. Jews who were more conservative and liberal always, I don't know, they davened in the same shuls, their kids married each other. It wasn't such a... What we're seeing today is not liberal progressivism. It's something else. You know, it's more identity politics and just siding with the victim no matter how evil. Not victim, siding with whoever is less powerful. And that's a really, it's a really dangerous thing. I mean, I appreciate what you just said. It was a very honest statement that you made about, you know, does it matter enough? Does Israel matter enough? Does your Judaism matter enough that you're going to stick up for it? Because you may lose some friends, you know? You might lose some friends. And if you just keep your mouth shut, if you just don't say anything, you know, you'll fit right in and it'll be okay. You know? It's a really interesting point. Any other comments, questions? Just feel free to speak up. We're a small group, but I don't want to just lecture here. Nice light stuff, right? But it does come out of the whole Purim thing. Yeah, what were you going to say, Fred?
Should you compare like Amalek to Sinwar and Hamas leadership to Amalek?
Yeah, I would. I mean...
Some people say yes, and some people say no.
So Amalek technically was a tribe in the wilderness that attacked the Jews when we left Egypt. So they're not technically Amalek, because Amalek is done. They're just an ancient biblical tribe. But Rabbi Soloveitchik said that they were characterized by an attempted genocide.
Mm.
And therefore, we give the status of Amalek to anyone that attempts genocide against the Jew. And, I mean, that's what Hamas's charter calls for. I mean, it says it explicitly there. Most important thing is for us not to be naive and to actually take our enemies at their word, for their word. Hitler tried to do everything he said he would do. And I believe that the Iranians, if they could, and I believe that if Hamas had a nuclear weapon, it would use it against Israel. It would. They really believe in this.
Wouldn't take twice.
No, they would 100% do it. And October 7th was just more evidence for us. Maybe we knew that intellectually, but we didn't really believe it. You know, because we would never do such a thing. You know, even people who we, you know, our enemies, we would never try to wipe out their families and their, you know, we just don't do that. I mean, and that's the you know, Israel's not doing what they're doing, by the way, trying to pinpoint the terrorists and try to save as many innocents, even though they're being accused of being reckless. They're not doing this to score points in the world because they're not scoring any points in the world. They're not. They're just losing Jewish lives by not carpet bombing the Gaza Strip. But they don't believe it's moral. I also don't believe it's moral. You can't just wipe out 2 million people because you have the firepower to do so. But there's no question that Hamas would do that. But getting back to our situation here, the reason the Purim story is really important is because it helps us as American Jews kind of, you know, get a little historical perspective on what happens outside of Israel when stuff goes bad. Okay, so first lesson is don't be naive. Let's do a few more. Second lesson, human monsters, though an enemy and threat to all mankind, somehow specialize in the hatred of Jews. They may be proponents of particular ideologies of the left or the right, agnostic, secularist, or reactionary. Yet they strangely become preoccupied with the Jew and derive particular delight from tormenting him. So he's saying that somehow the Jew is more vulnerable. Now, I don't know if anyone can articulate this, why this is. Why is the Jew somehow more vulnerable than, let's say, other ethnicity groups? Because you got to ask that question. Somehow we seem to get blamed for the ills of most societies going wrong. I mean, Germany did it twice, certainly in the Second World War. Why the Jew? Now, he says here, this hatred of the Jew emerges from any economic or political spectrum. Hitler's national ambition need not have involved Jews as a central obsession. There was nothing in his policy of expansionist nationalism that required the annihilation of European Jewry. By the way, it slowed him down. This man was trying to take over the world, and he had to, you know, utilize so many of his SS officers in these camps. And similarly, communism as an economic and political ideology could have functioned without adopting any particularly repressive policies against Jews. Yet the Jew is continually caught up in the thick of events which are completely unrelated to him. At times, great empires vie with each other, and the Jew is forced to cast his lot with the less objectionable, thus unwillingly becoming involved. It was a rude awakening for the Jews of Persia to discover that the main preoccupation of the new prime minister was to annihilate them. Okay, he was even willing to bribe the king. Haman gave up with a lot of money, tens of thousands of silver talents he offered to deposit into the king's treasury just for the royal insignia, the stamp, the king, Tabat HaMelech, the Megillah says, the king, to be able to send out those letters in the name of Achashverosh to kill the Jews, right? Why was it worth all that money? No one has a violent hatred for the United States or France, although particular policies may be vehemently decried. The mere existence of the Jew, however, irritates Amalek, and his hatred can suddenly and violently erupt and be translated into mass murder. Why is this so? And he's just, there's no answer. It's an absurd situation which has accompanied us since the dawn of our history. Don't try to make sense. It doesn't make sense. There's no logical, rational explanation for this. Third lesson, and this is very important. All Jews share a common destiny. The hatred of the Jews and animosity directed against the entire group, it's not necessarily confined to religious or ethnically conscious Jews who are more conspicuous by their separateness. The hatred of Haman is commodious enough to embrace the Jew with a mezuzah on his doorpost, as well as the Jew whose home is devoid of all symbols of Jewishness. Same thing with Hitler. He didn't go for the Hasidim and ignore Reform Jews. He didn't target Reform Jews and ignore Hasidim. It didn't matter. In fact, the same Rabbi Soloveitchik, whose article we're reading, when he went to visit the Lubavitcher Rebbe on his 80th birthday, these were two great rabbis of the generation. So, you know, I don't know if you guys know, there are a lot of internal different groups, even within the Orthodox world. The Chabad, Lubavitchers, and Hasidic groups didn't get along with the Lithuanian groups. And when Rabbi Soloveitchik went to see his old friend, the Rebbe, you can actually see it on YouTube, by the way, the whole thing was filmed. Rabbi Soloveitchik went on the 80th birthday of Lubavitcher Rebbe. These were two great rabbinic giants of the generation. And when he left, Somebody came over to him and said, it's unbelievable, the descendant of the Vilna Gaon, that was Rav Soloveitching, and the descendant of the Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who's one of the founders of the Hasidic movement, are sitting together making a l'chaim, because they were always fighting with each other. They had different approaches. One was more rational, one was more mystical. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, no, you're incorrect. We were brought together before this moment. He said, Hitler. Hitler didn't distinguish between a Litvisha Jew and a Hasidic Jew. Hitler didn't distinguish between a conservative reform and Orthodox, right? And what ends up happening, and this is what happened on October 7th, is that Jews were fighting against each other. There was a lot of fighting going on in Israel before October 7th. Religious, non-religious, the Supreme Court things. And I'm not saying they're not important issues. And I also think that the media exaggerated, as the media likes to do, the infighting. Because a sign of a healthy democracy is going to be protests and a little fighting going on. Okay? Some people liked the reforms that were being proposed for the Supreme Court. Some felt that they were inappropriate and it was threatening the democracy of Israel. It's a legitimate debate, honestly. The problem was is we were vilifying our, you know, the opponent. And by the way, when you do that, and that's happening a lot in this country too, and we'll have another election, and I'm sure it's going to happen again, that's really bad. I remember growing up watching debates. They were really boring. Debates, presidential debates. Watch Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan's debate. They, for an hour and a half, they're talking about issues. It wasn't one slur. It wasn't one nasty comment made one person to the next about their character, about their personage. It was all about the issues. So it was a little boring. Now it's much more interesting, but they sound like children. I remember the last debate between Hillary and two presidential debates ago, between Hillary and Trump. One of my kids was like walked away in the middle. My daughter, she was a teen. Yeah, she goes, they sound like such babies. They're being like such babies. Like, why don't they talk about what they're really, you know? And it turned a lot of people off to politics. But I don't want to say sometimes we need our enemies to unite us. But one of the positive things that's come out of October 7th is that Jews are not fighting with each other anymore.
So it's funny you say that, because that's what I was thinking, because in like the U.S., they're just continuing to divide within different people, then within the groups, then they keep dividing. And with the Jews, doesn't matter like who it was, because they were divided in Israel and then they came together and were hated for that.
I know.
Because you can't divide us as much as you might want to, because that's what...
So there's a difference between dividing. Does that mean, in order for us to all be unified, does that mean we have to agree with each other? Because that ain't ever happening. Two Jews, three opinions. It's just not going to happen. And that's the beauty of living in a liberal democracy. You don't have to agree with another person, and you could still be their friend. And you can have a proper conversation. And not. But when you start vilifying the other and trying to attribute ill will to the other person's opinion and the other person's position, and then you just sort of delegitimize not just the opinion, but the person. So that's the distinction, is attacking the argument and not the person. And I think this country, I mean, I think we're struggling with that terribly. And I'll tell you, Israel will eventually get rid of Hamas, please God, sooner than later. And hopefully we'll deal with Hezbollah. Israel will have to deal with Hezbollah in the north, which is a much more serious threat. And then when all the dust settles, we're going to have to live with each other. And we cannot continue to live with each other like we were before October 7th. It was not pleasant. It was not pleasant. Rabbi Feldman, who was our East Side rabbi for 17 years, made Aliyah 5 years ago. And Kevin and Allison, who some of you remember from MJE, they made Aliyah, and they're working with Rabbi Feldman on a new initiative in Tel Aviv, MJE over there. Very exciting. But this happened on Yom Kippur, right? This attack took place on Simchas Torah, which is a week later. On Yom Kippur, Rabbi Feldman was running a Yom Kippur service with a mechitza, with a separation between the men and the women. It was a modest mechitza like we have here, but the Supreme Court had passed a crazy rule the day before. He didn't even know about it, that if you're conducting a service in a public area, you can't have mechitza. I don't know why that is. You never have such a rule in the United States because the separation of church and state here, there isn't in Israel. That gets complicated over there. And somebody came in the middle of his service and started pulling the mechitza down. Now, he didn't want to make a scene. He was very smart. He took a couple of Israeli flags and used it instead. Was he going to pull down the Israeli flags? But then he just continued the service without it and left out the parts of the service that you need a mechitza for. Okay? But it was like a nasty thing to do. As opposed to, you know, did you hear there's a rule you're not supposed to? He didn't know. It was the day before, and it wasn't publicized. And stuff like that was happening. Now, I wouldn't say that there was like that's like a daily occurrence. It was not a daily occurrence, but there was a lot of... So that's another lesson from Rabbi Soloveitchik, which is that we share a common destiny, and we have to figure out a way of staying together. I'll tell you one last story. It was very inspirational, where there could have been literally a civil war between Jews. Anybody know a moment in Jewish history, in modern Jewish history, where a Jew could have literally taken up arms against Jew? And that was in Israel, in the beginning of the formation of the state. Because the Haganah, which was sort of the mainstream beginning of what became the IDF, led by Ben-Gurion, the main, right? There were these other underground groups, and there were large underground groups, and they had a big fight between in the Jewish community. Do we just fight the Arabs, who were trying to keep the Jews from having a state? Or do we also fight the British? Because the British were making it very, very difficult for the Jews to have their own state. And the they were living under the British mandate. And the British were also keeping Holocaust survivors from coming into Israel. They were putting them in DP camps. They were putting them in behind barbed wire again. Mm. And I hate to say it, but the white paper mandate, which controlled Israel for decades by the British, I mean, millions of Jews could have been saved. Millions. Because there was nowhere for the Jew to go. What's that?
Why do you need to say it?
Because we think of the British, Winston Churchill, we think of them as our friends, as, you know, like, I hate to say it because they're like another liberal democracy. We're allies, the United States, England, they're, you know. And
same with us turning chips around as well.
Yeah, the United States did the same thing. True. Okay. I still hate to say it. I hate to say it about the United States. I used to talk to my father about this. What were you going to say?
Oh, didn't Ben-Gurion actually send in a unit into Europe to try to get people out?
Yeah, they were sending in people to get Holocaust survivors out, and that's how the IDF developed. It was from Holocaust survivors who were being smuggled under the British under the British blockade. But here's what happened between Jew and Jew. There was the Irgun, the Etzel, there were a couple of underground groups that were fighting against the British, and they were not getting along with like Ben-Gurion's mainstream Palmach. Haganah. Palmach was another underground group initially. And there was one moment where there was a ship coming. It's called the Altalina, very famous. And the ship was coming, and Ben-Gurion and the Haganah thought it was it was bringing arms in for the Irgun, for one of the underground Jewish groups. So they started firing on the ship. And Menachem Begin, who later became Israel's prime minister, was my favorite. Okay, he was my favorite Israeli politician ever. He gave the order to not fire back. He said the last time a Jew shot back at another Jew was
destruction.
Around that time was the Second Temple destruction, where Jews in Jerusalem were fighting each other as to how to deal with the Romans, the Roman siege being laid against Jerusalem. Do we make peace with the Romans? Do we fight against the Romans? And he says, and an almost civil war broke out, and look what happened there. We lost the temple, and he says, we're not doing that again. He saved, and it was an unbelievable thing. So it's not so simple. That's another great lesson. And let's go to the fourth lesson. And this, I'm going to end on a positive, upbeat note, because it could be a really depressing class when we talk about Haman and anti-Semitism. I want to end on a positive note. By the way, before I end, Rabbi David Lichtenstein, who is an amazing rabbi, is giving a talk. We usually have the 8 o'clock fellowship class right here, just for the fellows, but anyone is invited to stay. He has the most popular podcast in the Orthodox community. It's called Headlines. He's a very successful entrepreneur, real estate developer. and a really fascinating guy, and he agreed to come, and he's giving a class tonight, like in about 5 or 6 minutes. So if anybody wants to stick around, if you can, I understand, that's cool. Let me just finish with the last. Also, Saturday night is our Purim party, which starts at 8:30, and we would love for you guys to come and Purim with us. I don't know who chose this, but you have to come as a Wild West. You can just come as you are. You don't have to.
Sunday.
Saturday night, Sunday,
okay,
is Purim. But Saturday night is the big party.
Okay, but there's
on Sunday.
There's also a Purim feast on Sunday at 6 o'clock. And there's an earlier Megillah reading at 5 o'clock on Sunday as well, 5 p.m. Okay, so last lesson is that God does not abandon his people. Let me just see. Let's just read this. The previous lessons soberly alert us to the fearful possibilities which forever threaten the Jew. The fourth lesson is reassuring and inspiring, and may very well be the primary purpose of the Persian galut. Galut means exile. There the Jew discovered a basic existential condition which protects him whenever he's threatened by satanic enemies. When imminent annihilation confronts the Jew, God always sends his agents. Now, who was God's agents in the Purim story? So we'll say, well, what do you mean? It was a coincidence. And that's what the word Purim means. It means lottery. It's just happenstance. We just happened to have a very beautiful woman named Esther who was chosen by the king. Okay, what was this nice Jewish girl in the king's harem? Okay, she was a nice religious girl. She was taken against her will, but she used her position to basically save the Jewish people. Right? But we don't believe that that was just happenstance. We believe that God was behind that. And there's too many coincidences and little things that sort of just happen here and there in the story. I mentioned one last week, the king can't sleep, beginning of chapter 6 in Megillah Esther. And then he calls to one of his servants and says, bring me my book of Chronicles, my book of remembrances. And they just happen to open up to the page that records that Mordechai had foiled an assassination attempt against the king. And he calls Mordechai to be rewarded again, Haman. And that allows Esther later on to use that situation to point the finger at Haman. Right? Because Haman had prepared the gallows for Mordechai. But who was Mordechai to Ahasuerus? He was a hero. He saved him. And now he's showing him great honor. So why is Haman trying to kill him? Like, Queen Esther was able to use that. But how did that whole little thing unfold? Just coincidence? Right? There's no such thing as coincidence. Paradoxically, any man of flesh and blood can presume to represent God. Prophets ordinarily transmit messages or perform acts dictated by God, but they do not represent God. Nevertheless, it's a basic Jewish concept that God functions primarily through man. The redemption of the Jew is always achieved through a shliach of Hashem. A shliach is like a shlichut, a messenger. In the awaited messianic era, the redemption will come about through the agency of an endowed human being, the king of the Mashiach. In the Talmud, Rabbi Hillel expressed the view that there will not be an individual Messiah in the future. God himself will bring about the messianic era. Look at the last paragraph. In the Animam, the principles of faith formulated by Maimonides, I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Mashiach. And he says at the end that I will wait for him daily. The expectation is for a personal Messiah, not merely a messianic era. In Exodus, we note that God heard the cries of the suffering Israelites. And one verse after another, it's clear God was ready for the redemption. What delayed it? The next verse explains it. Moses was a shepherd of sheep for his father-in-law Yitro. Moses was not yet ready for his mission. So God waited, because God works through messengers. He doesn't want to just do things himself. He works through normative people. And so it takes a little longer. It took 7 days of persuasion, our sages say, before Moses, in his overwhelming humility, could be induced to accept his assignment. Similarly, in Shushan, an old man, Mordechai, and his young niece, Esther, had to work out their sense of mandate and the strategy to be employed before the Geula process could unfold. To retain a vivid awareness of these four lessons of the Persian exile is critically important for Jewish survival. Even as we marshal all of our human resources in the face of hovering physical dangers, we have an unswerving faith that God will intercede. The final triumph will be his and ours too. I wanted to end with that because we're in a Purim moment in our history right now. We've got almost like a Haman kind of decree hanging over our head with what happened on October 7th and the kind of missiles that Hezbollah has waiting, just waiting to be deployed. And we have to not lose faith, not only in each other and remain united, but and never be naive, continue to believe in the goodness of man, but not be so naive that man cannot become Satan. And also that we're a little more vulnerable than others. We spoke about that as well. But that on the positive side, we all share a common destiny. And I really believe, this sounds very trite, but there's nothing we can't do when we're united. And almost anyone can take us out when we're divided. So remaining united is extraordinarily important. And also remaining faithful in God. Because you can't really explain our continued existence after the Purim story and the Hanukkah story and all these episodes in Jewish history without believing in some higher force that's trying to continue, to make sure that we continue to exist. I would love to hear any alternative explanations of how you and I are still here talking about this today. Any other questions, comments? I've never ended on time, so I'm not sure what to do with myself.
This could have been written a month ago.
Written a month ago. Rabbi Soloveitchik, I think, wrote this sometime in the 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
But these, it's unbelievable. Just real quickly, Purim, we read the Megillah twice. That's the scroll of Esther. We'll read it once on Saturday night, 8:30, and then you can come on Sunday morning. There's some readings here downstairs. We're going to have a little Minyan Madness at 9 on the 11th floor. And then at 10 on the 3rd floor, there's a Megillah reading. And then 5 p.m. later on up here. And then the Purim Feast at 6. A lot of fun stuff. I think we could use some celebrating. And there's a challah bake here tomorrow night. If anybody would like to learn. I forgot to mention, tomorrow also is a fast day to commemorate the fast of Esther. It starts, I wrote this down, early in the morning, if you're not a good faster and you want to. What's that?
I think it's at 5:44 in the morning.
That sounds right. And I think it ends like 7:20 or something like that.
It's at 7:40. And it starts at
5:44 a.m. Okay. But, I thank you all for being here. And if you want to stick around, Rabbi Lichtenstein's going to be here in about 5 minutes. And there's some cold pizza and pasta. And what else do we eat on Purim, by the way?
Hamantashen.
We eat Hamantashen, and we give, what do we give to each other? We give Mishloach Manot. That really creates a lot of unity and connectedness. Try to prepare yourself a little Mishloach Manot. You're supposed to give at least one to a fellow Jew. All it is like a, you can do the cheap model, you can go to town on it. You know, it's just like a plate and put two species of foods, make sure they're kosher. Any two species of foods, it can be a Hamantashen. It could just be a bottle of wine. It could be a piece of pizza. That's a little weird. But you could do that. Any type, two types of foods. It could be a drink. And give them to a fellow Jew. Wish him a happy Purim. The last mitzvah is to give money to the poor. We have a very important Jewish tradition on Purim that whereas the rest of the year when people stick their hand out, you can start asking questions. Where does the money go to? How do I know you're really poor? We do that. Purim, we don't ask questions. Somebody puts their hand out, you give them something. It's a day of really sharing the love. What's that? Yeah. Right. Feel free to donate to us. The MJ dinner is coming up, April 2nd, by the way. It's in less than 2 weeks. The MJ dinner, we have over 200 people signed up already, and we will sell out. So please join us. We would love to have you. We're celebrating 25 years of eating pizza and pasta on Wednesday nights. It's been a lot of pizza and pasta. Yeah.
I think I'm going to buy this book, actually. It sounds really interesting.
It's called, I'll tell you, it's
all
a
group. Like,
no, it's a lot of different articles. It's called Reflections of the Rav, which is referring to Rabbi Soloveitchik, Reflections of the Rav. I think it's like volume one. There's volume one and volume two. I think this is from volume one.
What was that other book you spoke about?
The pity of it all.
Oh, my God. That's just going to. It's like it's not an easy read. It's called The Pity of It All. But I'm telling you, it's worthwhile.
Good class. Thank you.
Thank you, man. It's a pleasure. So where are you guys going to be perm?
I'm going to be in Florida. I'm from South Florida as well, from Boynton Beach. So I'm going to be back with my family.
Right. Your family lives in Boynton?
Yeah.
Oh, my in-laws, blessed memory, still live there. Still go out there a lot. I know the Chabad rabbi there very well.
Yeah, and I went to, Ray Chick is West Boynton, but they're newer. The one on like El Clair Ranch Road is the one that's been around forever.
The Chabad?
Yeah, the Chabad. But we met at University of Florida.
So oh, cool.
Yeah. We're roommates over here.
We're here on 83rd.
So, yeah. Come around. It's a pleasure to have you. We have every Friday night now, 6:30. It's Albany.
Up here?
Right up here.
And you know, the first floral.
That's the Jew Saturday.
My friend goes there.
That's a beautiful coral.
Brought up your name one time. So we're
6:30 Friday night.
I thought
Chris had the toaster. I went to Friday, it was great. Then I went to Aaron's Saturday.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
that's great.
Extra
meat on
Charlie.
Yeah,
they have like a
small. Oh, we're doing an Israeli theme this Shabbos.
Thanks,
Ryan.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Guys, you're running around.
This is the general
stuff.
I have a friend who works for me. But I am running to do a little bit of work. I'd like to stay for
5 hours.
Yeah.
Lights don't group.
Yeah.
Before the
We're just going to keep the show
Sunday. Are you ready?
I'm ready. What can we talk about?
I have no idea.
I know. Rabbi Wild tells me to stay, though. I go there.
Engaged.
Engaged.
I'm kind of like,
Yeah, before that.
It's a different link that you won't find in
Ashley. No, I'm Haman. Congratulations. Now we live in a thing called a head. You know how your wife is gonna have to go in that one? I feel like it would suck. Imagine being like a line for a DVD role.
Dylan, what'd you learn?
There's more of that.
No.
I'd like to hear that. All right, guys, have a seat, please. Yes.
I got it.
I think I'm on top.
Should take a pouch. Unless you're very serious.
No, I don't want to.
I want to be with the spitting
distance. I want spitting
distance.
Are we saying?
Crash a minion or something and just like make it an announcement.
I've been here
about 10 minutes. Yeah. Over here? We have an announcement.
Is that Paul? I don't even recognize you.
Whoa, what are you talking about?
I haven't seen you in so long.
Todd, come here every day.
He's here at 9 o'clock minion every morning.
He was, 9 o'clock menu? I don't think they have an 8 o'clock.
Tequila is really hitting you, huh?
Oh, we're gonna have a 9 o'clock menu.
That's why he's here at Henry. That's why he's here at 9.
He wants some tequila. I played basketball last night, and my back is not the same. I'm getting too
old. Oh, you started that league?
Yeah, we're so bad. We're the worst. I'm so glad that we honored Troy with your donation.
Rest in power.
I
mean, we gotta go to the fridge. We'll get some stuff.
As long as my jacket is.
Yeah.
You probably have the best.
Okay, I will do that.
Oh.
Taking up two seats.
I'm saving this for someone.
Oh, who?
Troy.
Which one? Dylan?
Dylan.
So I'm good.
I don't know how much longer I can hold two seats.
What's going on? Okay. Same old.
He never took
it. He wasn't present.
What's up, Tom?
What's up? Are you doing well? I don't know. He said that he never took it.
Living life.
Ladies and gents, we just want to wish Fred and Lily a mazel tov. They have to run right now. But we just want to say no.
I know that's Rabbi Miller.
I actually kind of believe in Rabbi.
That's way too Hasidic for Rabbi. Too wild to write like a Rabbi Soloveitchik commentary on the Megillah.